Happy New Year and welcome to Iowa Public Radio's January 2014 edition of the Iowa Arts Showcase, our monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Thanks for joining us. This month, we'll learn about the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's plans to defrost Iowa's wintry landscape with their sultry production of Bizet's Carmen. We'll explore the It's Not Your Grandparents' Farm or Is It exhibit, currently running at the Grout Museum District in Waterloo. We'll stop by the New Bow neighborhood in Cedar Rapids to learn about one of Iowa's creative sanctuaries, Legion Arts and the CSPS. And we'll hear about the Midwest premiere of what the New York Times called a splendid musical by the Iowa composer, librettist, and stage director Robert Lindsay Nassif. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
This idea of sexism, feminism, the racism, the oppression of the gypsies, that's the tack I'm taking. And I haven't done that before with Carmen. And I'm excited about that. I think it'll give the opera a kind of a realism and a thematic purpose that I'm interested in exploring.
Bill Ferrara, guest stage director, sharing his take on the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's production of Bizet's Carmen. The Cedar Rapids Opera Theater is presenting Carmen on January 17th and 19th at the Paramount Theater in Cedar Rapids with members of Orchestra Iowa, all under music director and conductor Daniel Kleinknecht. Bill inherited his love of opera at a young age from his dad.
My father was an Italian immigrant, and we had a stack of old 78s at home, and he took me to the opera whenever we could in Washington and New York, and so I grew up loving opera. And I taught at the University of Northern Iowa for 11 years, and I came here to the University of Oklahoma in 1995. I direct and teach in South America, in Brazil, and in Italy, and all around the United States.
And you went to Indiana to get your degrees?
Indiana University School of Music. At the time, it was the only place where you could get a graduate degree in opera stage direction, yes.
And you also have a book that's going to be coming out next year.
Yes, it's the first of a series. It's Staging Scenes from the Operas of Mozart, a Guide for Teachers and Singers, published by Scarecrow Press. And it'll be available on Amazon.com also.
Now, you have directed over 150 productions, which is quite amazing in itself, and quite an array of productions, too, not just operas.
That's right. At UNI, I was the director of Lyric Theater, so I directed the musicals as well. And actually, I started out acting, so I've directed plays as well as musicals and operas. But operas are my love, and that's what I do now.
Tell us about your production that you're going to be putting on with the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater coming up on January 17th and January 19th.
It's Bizet's Carmen, I think the world's most beloved opera. It's been done so many times in so many different ways. I went back to the novella, the Prosper Mérimée novella, to find some roots for the story and roots for the character. And what I discovered is that the characters are quite different from what we usually see on stage. In particular, Carmen isn't that sort of sexpot temptress. In the novel, she's a young gypsy girl growing up in a very tough neighborhood, and so she develops skills to survive. What she wants more than anything else is freedom, la liberté, and she uses sex only as a tool to gain her independence and her self-determination. So I'm looking at the opera in terms of gender and feminism and finding some very interesting themes. Mérimée was part of the new realism in French literature, and literature always seems to lead the way. And there was a new realism in painting and music as well. Bizet wrote Carmen in 1875. And at the premiere, it was very shocking because of the realism. In fact, the manager of the Opéra Comique asked him to have a happy ending for the show. Can you imagine, instead of having Carmen killed? But no, he held to his idea of this sort of gritty realism. If you think of Manet's realistic period, those famous paintings like the execution of Maximilian showing the firing squad. In fact, I'm using some of Manet's paintings as tableau, as inspiration for some of the tableau in our production. Anyway, so Carmen, the novel, covers a long span of years. So we see Carmen grow up from this poor girl working in a tobacco factory, very oppressed, very beat up by the oppressive male society and the military. And she starts to gain her own power and she becomes the leader of a band of smugglers. It's a very tough life. They're smuggling tobacco and whiskey from Gibraltar up through the mountains. She and Don José fall in love. I think what she finds so attractive in Don José, this soldier, is that he's an outlaw as well. He's a murderer and he's serving time in the army, and she convinces him to go AWOL for her, and they take up the gypsy life and smuggling. But he is the possessive type and he wants to turn her into a submissive wife, but she wants freedom above all. And so she leaves him and she becomes more and more successful, and we see her grow in status and independence as Don José descends, just disintegrates in front of our eyes into madness because he's so obsessed with Carmen. And in the end, she comes to the bullring on the arm of Escamillo, this handsome rock star toreador, and José confronts her and says, "You have to be with me. You have to be only with me." And she says, "Frappe-me donc, ou laissez-moi passer." She says, "Kill me or let me go." She'd rather die than be trapped. And so he does. He murders her and then is himself executed. So it's an opera about fate and so forth, but also about a woman transgressing society's laws, society's rules, and of course in the 19th century she has to die for it. So that's my take on the opera.
And on the other side of Carmen, you have this good girl that is part of the cast as well.
Micaela is from José's home village, and she is sort of the girl next door, and she comes with a message from José's mother. He seems to have mother issues. I think there's a great deal of guilt in José in the way he's treated his mother, in the way he left home. So Micaela represents a kind of a redemption for him, but he finds her just a little bit boring and conventional, and he is just carried away by this fantastic, colorful gypsy girl. And so he goes AWOL rather than having the kind of life he's supposed to, going home, being a farmer, marrying Micaela.
And living happily ever after.
Yeah, it doesn't happen that way in the operas, does it?
No. Now, tell us a little bit about the main characters and the people that will be singing those roles.
Carmen is Janara Kellerman. She's a fabulous, fiery, dark-eyed, voluptuous mezzo-soprano. And I think she's very interested in the acting and the characterization. And so we're going to see her progress from a girl, tough but really innocent and vulnerable in her heart, all the way to the fabulous woman, the Carmen with the mantilla and the castanets that she becomes. She is quite a dynamic performer, Janara. Alok Kumar is Don José, very good-looking fellow, tenor, lives in New York. I think all of the leads are professional singers from New York with management. he's also very interested in the psychology of this character, this alcoholic, obsessive, violent, renegade soldier who descends into madness. So I'm very excited about working with these folks.
And tell us about the Toreador.
Escamillo, yes, he's got the famous aria, of course, and he is like a rock star in his day, very popular. The whole city of Seville turns out to see him, and he provides some color and some brightness in this otherwise fairly dark opera.
And you mentioned a bit that the Toreador has a famous aria. Tell us about some of the other very, very famous music that comes from this opera and how you feel that incorporates into your directing style.
The music is wonderful. It is harmonically very advanced and rhythmically so vital and fiery with all of the Spanish influence and the colors in the orchestra. People will immediately recognize the Habanera, which is Carmen's entrance aria. They will recognize the Toreador song, of course, the Seguidilla, the famous gypsy dances. The choruses are wonderful, and they have a particularly fantastic group of choristers, a large chorus in Cedar Rapids, to sing all these very famous choruses. The audience will, if they haven't heard Carmen before, they certainly will recognize the music from cartoons and commercials, and it certainly is the most famous and popular music. I've incorporated a lot of dance and movement into the production to illustrate this wonderful rhythmic and Spanish background to the story.
Bill Ferrara, guest stage director of the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater, talking about their upcoming January 17th at 8 p.m. and 19th at 2 p.m. presentations of Bizet's Carmen at the Paramount Theater in Cedar Rapids. Members of Orchestra Iowa will serve as the opera orchestra under the direction of the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's executive director, Daniel Kleinknecht. The Cedar Rapids Opera Theater will also be providing an adult forum, a pre-concert brunch, and prior to each performance, curtain talks, along with a young artist production of The Billy Goat's Gruff. For Carmen tickets, you may call the Orchestra Iowa box office at 319-366-8203 or go online to orchestraiowa.org. For more details about the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater, please see their website at cr-opera.org. Just ahead on the Iowa Art Showcase, we'll hear about It's Not Your Grandparents' Farmer, Is It? Exhibition, being presented by the Grout Museum District in Waterloo. We'll discover details about the Legion Arts' recent renaissance since the flood of 2008. And we'll learn about the off-Broadway musical Opal, composed by an Iowa native, called a rare achievement by the New York Times. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
Lived here all my life, and I went to the Grout Museum as a young child, and it was one of my favorite places to go. So I think that this is a real gem in this area. We're a top-notch museum. We've got a lot of really interesting exhibits. We opened an exhibit a couple of years ago called Heritage Hall, which is a timeline of photographs and artifacts of how the area has changed, and that's fascinating too. And I believe the Grout Museum's a great place to come and learn about where you're living now and I've been there 20 years, and a lot of the reason I'm still there is because I'm very passionate about the museum, and I believe in what it does, which is teaches people about our history, and that's so important to know where you came from and know where you're headed.
The curator for exhibits for the Grout Museum District, Robin Venter, talking about one of their current exhibits called It's Not Your Grandparents' Farm, or Is It? This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. The Grout Museum District in Waterloo includes the Grout Museum of History and Science, the Blue Dorn Science Imaginarium, and the Rensselaer Russell and Snowden House Museums. The newest addition to the Grout Museum District is the official Veterans Museum for the state of Iowa. The Sullivan Brothers Iowa Veterans Museum honors the service and sacrifice of all Iowa veterans from the Civil War to the present. The Grout Museum District engages conversations across generations between young and old alike with at least 8 new exhibits each year.
We opened It's Not Your Grandparents' Farm, or Is It, last April, actually, and it's been very popular. It just seemed natural to do this. When you think about Iowa, everybody thinks about farms, and when you think about Iowa farms, you think about family farms that grow corn and beans and pigs and cattle, and that's all very true. And, you know, in the last several years, those farms have grown very big, very large family farms, like maybe 1,000, 2,000 acres or so. And we wanted to do an exhibit that not only talked about those farms, but also talked about the farms that were still small, anywhere from 14 acres up to 200 acres that were, you know, supporting families or maybe adding to the income of the family, but growing different crops, unusual crops. And we've got, of course, Hansen's Dairy Farm is an example of a very successful smaller family farm. Another example of farms that we have is the Genuine Fox Farm, which is a CSA farm or a truck farm. They grow vegetables and sell them at farmers markets. We have Tiny But Mighty Popcorn. We have the Seed Savers, which is a wonderful place up in Decorah that grows heirloom seeds. We've got a buffalo farm and a winery. And we also have a distillery that we've kind of focused on. And honey, a honey farmer as well. And it's just a wonderful opportunity to show people that, you know, yeah, hey, we do grow corn and beans and pigs and hogs, but there's also this type of farming. The exhibit also tells a history, a timeline of farming from the pioneer farm, where they were sustaining themselves, to how these farms grew into farms that, you know, were selling their crops and making a living off of them, and how technology has changed farming, and actually all the way up to the current farming practices with hybrid seeds and feeds and all the fertilizers and the equipment that is allowing a few farmers to farm thousands of acres, and how that's changing the landscape. And technology changes a lot of things, and this state is still able to produce food that feeds the world, and it's pretty fascinating, the whole storyline. I think one of the facts that just kind of blew me away when I was doing this was that when you go to the grocery store, 75% of the groceries in your cart are somehow related to corn. And we've got a case that demonstrates that, that shows a lot of these products that you would normally put into your cart.
Now, you also have a diorama. Tell us about that.
Well, you have actually a couple of them. When you turn the corner and walk into this area, what you see is a farmer's market. You see booths that we had, and you go into these booths, and let's say the honey air, Bombach honey, you go up to that and you see some of the product in there. You see a lot of what it takes, the beehive, what it takes to make the honey. and you see pictures and so forth, so that you learn a little bit about that particular type of farm. You go into the next booth and you see Hansen's Dairy Farm, and you learn about that type of production and what it takes to be part of Hansen's Dairy Farm or whatever. We also have a little roadside stand. So we just kind of wanted to immerse people into, you know, give people the thought, when you go to a farmer's market, think about what this is doing. And I know one of the things that I did this year, because I had never done anything like this, is I joined a CSA, which is what the Genuine Fox Farm is, a CSA. And they're one of our people that have a booth. And I was just blown away when I tried a tomato, and I'm not a big tomato eater, but I tried a tomato that was picked that morning, and compared to some of the stuff that I'd gotten at the grocery store that was picked 2 weeks ago, it was like, I couldn't believe how delicious that was. And I'm just usually a grocery shopper kind of person, but this has changed my point of view. And so we just kind of wanted people to think about, you know, buying local and what that means and how important that is. And in the middle of this little diorama, we have a children's farm as well that children can go and dig into the dirt. It's rubberized mulch, but they can dig in the dirt and they can plant little carrots and potatoes and dig them and then go over and sell them at their little farmer's market booth as well. And we were lucky to partner with a lot of different people, from farmers to, we even had a Boy Scout, James Bamber, who was from Cedar Falls, who organized and came and built the booths for us for his Eagle Project. We worked with the CAAA, the Center for Energy and Environmental Education. We worked with them to get information about buying local. And we partnered with Silos and Smokestacks. And that partnership actually started 2 years prior to this exhibit, when we got a grant to hire a summer intern who did a lot of research and went and interviewed a lot of the farmers and so forth. And we have some of those interviews that are showing in the exhibit as well. And then on top of it, Silos and Smokestacks continued their partnership by lending us a lot of photographs that they've collected over the years through their contests. It's open to people to take pictures of farming operations or anything that's related to the Silos and Smokestacks mission. And we've got a gallery, a whole wall of these photos, which are just absolutely gorgeous photos of Iowa farms or agriculturally related subjects. Plus, we have other photos that we blew up throughout the exhibit that just kind of shows a lot of the farming practices done in Iowa as well. And a lot of those pictures, some of them came from individuals, but a lot of those pictures came from Silos and Smokestacks. So we're very lucky in this area to have all these places that we could draw from and get information and borrow things for our exhibit.
Why was it so important to do this exhibit?
I think even though people think of us as being a farm state, I think a lot of us that live here in Iowa, we know that there's a lot more to that than just being a farm state. But I think as Iowans, we also lose sight of what makes us great and what makes us a beautiful, wonderful state to be from. So I think it's important for not only people that are visiting here from out of state to see how diverse our agriculture community is, but also for people who live here to kind of bring them back to our core roots of who we are as a state and what does make us great. And so I think it kind of serves a lot of those purposes. And we are also starting a project where we're starting to go out and interview farmers. And so this is kind of a kickoff for that. And we're there again gathering these interviews to use for research, because a lot of these Iowa family farms that were the smaller operations, a lot of the farmers who grew up and saw the change from horses to tractors, they're still out there. And we're gathering this information from these farmers, and we're able to utilize it for projects like this or for future projects. And I just think it's important for people to realize where we came from and where we're heading. And this exhibit is just one example of what we can do.
the Grout Museum District's curator for exhibits, Robin Venter, talking about their exhibition, It's Not Your Grandparents' Farm, or Is It? Videos, photographs, farmer's market, and artifacts for the show will remain up through April of 2014. For more details, please see their website, groutmuseumdistrict.org, and click on It's Not Your Grandparents' Farm or Is It? Link listed in the What is Happening Now box on their homepage. Don't go away. We'll learn about the creative vision behind Legion Arts in Cedar Rapids, and we'll hear about a musical adventure created by Iowa composer, librettist, and stage director Robert Lindsay Nassif and his off-Broadway musical making its Midwest premiere. That's all ahead. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. This afternoon at 2, the Des Moines Metro Opera Guild's Des Moines chapter will be presenting guest baritone Michael Mays in recital. Michael Mays will perform with ISU's collaborative pianist Jody Goebel at the Cathedral Church of St. Paul in Des Moines. Tickets for this afternoon of operatic favorites will be available at the door. For more details about the Des Moines Metro Opera and the January 4th benefit recital featuring Michael Mays at the Cathedral Church of St. Paul in Des Moines with pianist Jody Goebel, please go to the education link on the Des Moines Metro Opera.org homepage and click on the DMMO Guild Events link.
Being in CSPS has informed my thinking so much about the ways in which art sort of spills over into other areas of people's lives. And I feel we've had the really good fortune to be in this building and in this neighborhood and this community during a time of change and transition, during a time where people are sort of, you know, rethinking the nature of community, the importance of creativity. There's a lot of talk these days about the creative corridor and the notion of creativity and lots of conferences and editorials and marketing campaigns. I feel that we have been really lucky to be on the ground dealing with those kinds of things in a very practical way. So not only like making statements about how great it is to have artists in the community, but what can we do with the resources we have practically to make artists more self-sufficient, more successful in their career, more sustainable. And a large part of that is sort of bringing a real artistic vision that encompasses our community, but is much broader than that, and then sort of working down to that sort of nitty-gritty level. So I think in terms of a legacy, just kind of, thinking about the arts in a more, in some ways, a broader and more fundamental way, and how they create to the community in ways that might not be readily apparent.
Co-founder and executive director of the Legion Arts, John Herbert. John Herbert, along with co-founder and multimedia artist Mel Andringa, first started collaborating in a performing arts company called the Drawing Legion. After 10 years of generating and touring their original performances in New York, Iowa City, and Amsterdam, they decided to find a new performance space. That's how they stumbled upon the Czech community in Cedar Rapids, now known as the New Bow neighborhood.
Well, the building, which was built in 1891, in some respects, it kind of fell into our laps, not once, but twice. In the early 90s, I was finishing a degree in Iowa City. Mel was concluding a teaching position at the University of Iowa. He had studio space in downtown Iowa City, which was being devoted to other purposes, so he needed a studio. And a friend of ours here in Cedar Rapids, Jane Gilmore, told us about this sort of amazing and largely empty building on the outskirts of downtown. And so we checked it out, and the owner was very amenable to having artists move in here, gave us a very, very, very advantageous, you know, rental rate. So that was sort of the beginning of CSPS, and we, you know, moved in the early 90s. About 18 years later, we were still renting the space in the building, the upper two floors, when the flood struck Cedar Rapids. So as an outcome of that, the building was in the middle of the flooded area, was severely damaged. The owner, who still inhabited the building but was interested in moving out, was especially interested in moving out after the flood because he really didn't have the resources to, you know, do the necessary repairs. So at that point, we were able to assemble the funding necessary to purchase and renovate the building through the generosity of the state of Iowa and the local community.
John outlines their mission.
Our organization is actually Legion Arts, and we do most of our activity here at CSPS, but we existed before we came to CSPS, and we continue to do things outside the building. So we try and distinguish between the two, but our mission, I think, has been shaped over the past 20 years, really, by being in this building. And in some respects, I think we try and honor the history of the building and its original intent. Was built by Czech immigrants in the late 19th century. Was really a place where they could sort of cultivate their original European culture at the same time adjusting to a new culture. And it also served a variety of purposes, you know, social, lots of parties and things going on here, political meetings, union organizing, birthday parties, you know, significant events in people's lives. At the same time, it had a, you know, a component of arts programming. They were still doing Czech language plays and music into the 60s here at CSPS. So there was always a kind of cross-cultural and very multidimensional aspect of the building that we've tried to maintain, both in bringing lots of artists from not only this country but from other countries as well. You know, some from the former Slavic countries of the Czech Republic and Slovakia, but also from Africa and South America and Asia, sort of expanding that sort of international emphasis that was always part of the building. We are, especially since we purchased the building and renovated it, we try and make our space available for as many kinds of community-based activities as possible. And then the third element is, I guess, what I would identify as a concern always for people's economic well-being. So from the very beginning, CSPS Hall was run by immigrants who would pay a modest amount, like a dime a week or something. And then if they had difficulties in their family, you know, they could, you know, draw on those funds to help get them through a rough patch. We've interpreted that to expand our mission. So we're serving local artists in ways that I think are really practical for them and helping them to develop their career. When we renovated the building, we included an arts incubator that houses a number of small arts organizations. We regularly offer workshops, offering artists and community cultural organizations sort of practical advice on how dealing with legal issues or career planning or marketing your work. We offer emergency grants to artists who are, you know, experiencing difficulties, whether that's a result of illness or fire or some other kind of, you know, challenge. So trying to provide a range of services, not only to local artists, but really artists throughout Iowa, in terms of them helping, like, you know, get further in their careers.
And you also, at this facility, have gallery space.
We do. We have a very vibrant arts presenting program. Currently, since the renovations, we are operating four galleries, including a new digital gallery, which focuses on, you know, film and video and related work. We have two theaters, a 200-seat proscenium theater, which is the original auditorium of the building, and then a new sort of smaller black box theater, which we call C-Space, which is seats about 65 people and is hosting a lot of you know, smaller productions, spoken word events, some conferences, poetry readings, activities like that. We do about 100 performing arts events a year, probably, and anywhere from like 10 to 20 you know, art exhibits in the galleries.
Tell us about your season.
We're a little bit odd on the arts landscape. Like to say, we're sort of halfway between some of the major presenters like Hanjour or Blue Dawn Gallagher or Des Moines Performing Arts and your local bar or coffee house. We do a lot of things on short notice. We do things all nights of the week. We do a great deal of music, both American music and music from other countries. much of our programming is sort of on the fly, and at the same time, we're moving more and more toward scheduling things further out. We don't really have a season as such, but we are trying to figure out ways to let people know that, you know, for example, that we're doing an opera by Robert Nesef called Opal. We want people to know about that far enough in advance that they can, you know, make their plans and get their tickets. We had three theater productions this past fall, which were just concluding, from Tokyo, Detroit, and Los Angeles. So those are the kinds of things that we want people to know about so they can work them into their plans. At the same time, we do a fair amount of music that if you've got friends visiting from out of town for the weekend and you're just looking for something to do on a Friday night, you know, there's a good chance we'll have a band from Ireland or a singer from Mali or some Celtic music from Minneapolis.
And also, you really reach out to people such as Robert Lindsay Nassif and Opal. He was looking for a place to do this opera, and you said, sure, come on in.
Well, that's another, I think, respect in which we're a little bit unique. Programmatically, I think it's, for most arts organizations, it's easy to focus on local artists or to focus on what I would call touring artists. It's a little bit hard to find that mix where you can sort of serve both. We feel that we have an interest in serving both those constituencies. And since part of our thinking about as we redesigned the building following the flood was, could we make the structure more available to local artists? So we built a small theater, for example, so that a local artist developing a new work, maybe it's not ready to go on the big proscenium stage and sell 200 tickets, but there's a smaller space where they can sort of try things out. And we also thought a lot about if our criteria were originality and excellence and a strong point of view, that we could present artists from around the world, that we could present artists from both coasts and from New Orleans and from Miami, as well as artists from, you know, Iowa City, Coralville, Des Moines and Cedar Rapids. So it's a challenge in a way to sort of find that balance and to communicate to the audience that while they might want to be really eager to see something from New York, they should also pay attention to what's going on in their own neck of the woods. So, but we see that as an exciting dimension of our mission that we're really been developing just in the past couple of years.
John talks about the evolution of Legion Arts after the flood of 2008.
In a sense, we were lucky. The building was really severely damaged. But at that point, Legion Arts was still just occupying the upper floors. So in terms of our damage to our business, you know, there was very little. And we were able, once we got things mucked out, to make our spaces available for, like, community meetings. A number of artists, of course, in the neighborhood had, you know, lost their studios or lost work or lost their homes. We had the good fortune, I think, of being able to sort of do a national fundraising campaign where we raised money and were able to award small grants, but I think significant grants to local artists to help them get back on their feet. But then again, you know, just in terms of presenting a meeting place, a, you know, sort of point of contact, you know, getting people together to talk to each other, especially in the very early days after the flood, I was happy that we could provide those services. And the strange thing was, we had just been in the process of planning our first Festival of World Music. It's now become an annual event called Landfall, and we do it every September. It was not the best time. I mean, it was really like months after the flood, and we thought about, like, you know, canceling it or postponing it for a year. But we had artists coming from all over the world, and we thought, what a great way to sort of, you know, invigorate the spirits of Cedar Rapids and give people a sense of activity and hope and, you know, optimism, you know, by not only presenting art and music, but doing it free and bringing artists from all over the globe, literally, you know, to sort of like be part of that event. So that and other events that we were able to do, I think really in terms of this neighborhood, which was really quite devastated, I think did a little bit to restore people's like sense of optimism and commitment because it was, you know, frankly, I think for all of us, a discouraging and pretty traumatic time. And another thing we did in that period was we had almost through luck, really, and coincidence, we have pretty strong connections in New Orleans that we've cultivated over the years. So we were able to bring up a number of artists and cultural organizers who had been through Katrina and were part of the rebuilding process there a few years ahead of Cedar Rapids, you know, to Cedar Rapids to share some of their experiences and some of their ideas. And they have really become sort of ongoing consultants, and we share a lot of information about, you know, what it takes to both the challenges and some of the opportunities of rebuilding a community after a disaster. A couple of years later, I was actually able to go to Japan and visit with artists and arts organizations in the area around Fukushima and share information with them. And we've since brought some artworks and artists from Japan, you know, to Cedar Rapids to help address that. So again, I think it's in some ways, it's that sort of dual emphasis that we see as Legion Arts. We think very grounded in our community and we try to be very responsive to the needs of our community, particularly the cultural and artistic needs. At the same time, we're fortunate enough to be well connected to a much larger sort of cultural network that, you know, that incorporates lots of cities in the U.S. as well as around the world.
John mentioned several upcoming performances at Legion Arts.
Well, we have a couple of exciting local projects. Sean Lewis is a sort of spoken word artist associated with Working Group Theater in Iowa City. Then we're really excited to be presenting a new solo work of his called Dogs of Rwanda. That'll be the, I think, second week in February. And then at the end of the month, in the beginning of February, we're presenting a new version of an existing opera by Robert Lindsay Nassif, based here in Cedar Rapids, a composer who's had quite a bit of success in New York and other venues, but remains committed, like we do, to staying here and doing his work in Cedar Rapids. So we're presenting a new version of an opera of his called Opal, for which he's written some new songs. And then we have, of course, you know, artists coming from around the world. I'm very excited. We have a really strong Celtic music sequence coming up this winter and spring that involves artists from the U.S. and from Ireland and from Eastern Canada. So really demonstrating the breadth of, you know, Celtic and Irish music, including a terrific young band called Full Set, which will be making their Iowa debut on St. Patrick's Day. I think that's, again, something that Legion Arts does at CSPS. You can hear lots of Irish music on St. Patrick's Day, but you rarely hear like actual Irish bands, so we're very fortunate that we've been able to do that sort of thing.
Co-founder and executive director of Legion Arts, John Herbert. Legion Arts is a founding member of the Iowa Cultural Corridor Alliance and also belongs to the National Association of Artists Organizations, as well as the National Performance Network. Legion Arts is known for its cutting-edge presentations of art, music, theater, and film. You can find out more information about John Herbert and Mel Andringa and the amazing history and post-flood renaissance of Legion Arts, as well as get tickets to events by going to their website at legionarts.org. While you're there, you can also check out their upcoming concerts and exhibits, along with investigating their remarkable support of young artists and their innovative assistance with creative workshops for artists. Just ahead, how the mysterious and magical childhood diary of Opal Whiteley won the imagination and the heart of an Iowa composer. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
Opal is my darling. I've written a number of musicals, worked on an opera, written some symphonic works. Opal has been my love for all these years, and I just cannot wait for people to discover it. I think that they will find it as magical and mesmerizing as I have. I believe that it will work its enchantment on people. So I'm just so excited about having the chance to show this piece. And this version has never been seen before. This is not the off-Broadway version. I've rewritten it. I've had a number of developmental productions of the show in the intervening years in San Diego, in Dallas, and other places. And I've continued working on it, and I've specifically rewritten it for this production. I'm also orchestrating the piece. It has never been fully orchestrated. So I'm really thrilled about that. So it'll be a premiere. There are four new songs in it that have never been heard before. And so this is a great opportunity both to present the show to people and also to revisit it.
Iowa's own composer, librettist, and stage director, Robert Lindsay Nassif. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jacqueline Hobloom. On January 31st and also on February 1st, 7th, and 8th, Robert Lindsay Nassif will be presenting the Midwest premiere of his musical Opal at the CSPS in Cedar Rapids. Robert will be premiering his new version of the musical with four new songs and a revised script. Opal is a very intimate show, leading Robert to orchestrate it for a small chamber orchestra of eight. When he was growing up, Robert went to see his first musical, Guys and Dolls, four times at Theater Cedar Rapids. He became passionate about musical theater and its creative possibilities. After that, there was no stopping him.
I wrote my first musical at age 13, produced it at Coe College there in Cedar Rapids at 14, and went on and got a degree in music and opera and MFA at the University of Iowa, and then moved to New York. And actually, the subject today is my musical Opal, and that had a lot to do with my moving, because I'd written the musical Opal and wanted to market it in New York, and that brought me there. And in New York, I've worked on Broadway, scoring Carol Burnett's autobiographical play directed by Hal Prince. I've had three shows off-Broadway, including Opal. And regionally, I've had a number of shows and did the dance and underscoring arrangements for Stephen Sondheim's latest musical, Bounce. Worked with Arthur Miller, worked with Disney's feature animation. So from Iowa, Opal led me on a merry journey.
And Opal itself won several awards. Tell us about those.
Yes, there's an award called the Richard Rogers Award, and Stephen Sondheim was the committee chair the year I won, and he selected Opal, and that funded the off-Broadway production in large part, and we were very successful off-Broadway, got a nice New York Times review, and the Schubert Organization produced it regionally in New Jersey, and there it won what's called the AT&T Award, which is just for outstanding theater. It went to the theater and the show, not to me. And off-Broadway, we received a number of Outer Critics Circle nominations.
Robert was studying at Iowa when he first heard about the diary of Opal Whiteley.
I was finishing my degree at the University of Iowa, and this friend called, and she was laughing and crying at the same time, and she said, "I have discovered this astonishing diary written by a 7-year-old girl in 1904. And she read a passage, and I was smitten. And I'll never forget the passage she read was, "I have thinks it must be an interest life to be a potato. Potatoes have sees of all that goes on under the earth, having so many eyes. I have wants to have more eyes. There's so much to see." And I was in love. I thought that text sings to me. I researched, I found the diary, which actually is published in a number of forms currently, and got the musical rights to it, musicalized it, and as I say, that took me to New York.
And what's even more fascinating is that this Opal really existed. Tell us about this whole story and how you met her.
Yes, she does exist. We never knew who exactly she was. There's no birth certificate for her, and that mystery is part of the diary and figures in my musical. But when I went to see her, she was living north of London in a care facility, and I arranged to see her. And I visited her, a dozen times for 12 years. And she became a sort of a grandmother figure to me. My first visit, of course, I had a million questions. And thereafter, I just came to bring her cheer and to tell her about my musical. She called it my opera, and play her some songs. And she became such an important figure in my life. And those meetings are some of my greatest memories. She actually passed away while we were in previews for Opal off-Broadway, so that was difficult, but kind of an interesting coincidence.
Tell us about this story and how you incorporated it into your musical.
The Diary of Opal Whiteley is just a mysterious, magical masterpiece of American primitive literature. It was written in 1904 by a woman they named Opal Whiteley. She says her name is Françoise d'Orléans, and it would actually make her the daughter born out of wedlock to Prince Henri d'Orléans, and her great-great-grandfather would have been Louis-Philippe, the last king of France. And as outrageous as that sounds, it actually is the simplest explanation for the whole diary. She wrote this diary really to survive. She finds herself at age 7, we think, in a lumber camp. She is an aristocratic child. She's out of place. And her place of refuge is her immense imagination. And she makes references in the diary that are just mind-boggling and enchanting. There's Peter Paul Rubens, the pig, who has poetry in his tracks. There's Michelangelo, the fir tree, who has a wise and understanding soul. Felix Mendelssohn, the mouse, whose squeakings are very musical. And although it was a Protestant lumber camp, she has Catholic mass and performs ceremonies and christenings in her forest cathedral in the woods, which is just a gathering of tall fir trees. So the diary text itself is just pure poetry. I deal exclusively with the text of the diary, leaving the mystery of her origins as another topic.
And there's some naysayers about her being of this lineage or whatever, mm-hmm. and about this diary and how it was all torn up into tiny little pieces. How does this all fit into this?
Yes. Actually, I have pages of the original diary. There's one other person in the world that has them, but Opal and her biographer saw that I got them, and her attorney, the solicitor for the Supreme Court of Protection. So I'm really the only person who has seen and studied the diaries, and I've studied them for 30 years. Yes, some people find the story hard to believe. Let me say that it doesn't matter to me if it's true or false. The diary is a masterpiece. So I just treat it as a piece of literature. I don't deal with the mystery of her origin. I simply have musicalized the story that she tells, a wonderful, enchanting, heart-wrenching, funny story that she tells in the diary. But none of the naysayers ever met her. And I knew her for 12 years. It's an interesting story. On one of my visits, my sister met Lord Acton, whose aunt I was visiting, and Aunt Mia knew Opal since 1939 until Opal's death in 92. My sister ended up marrying Lord Acton. So I've had the connection with Aunt Mia, who has passed away now, but she knew Opal and she knew aristocracy, as did Richard, and they both utterly believed her story. My sister is an attorney and says that there's more internal evidence in this diary than is often in criminal cases. So do I believe her? Absolutely. I think it's the simplest explanation. This French aristocrat had a child out of wedlock. When he died, the child was spirited away. I don't know how she ended up in Oregon, but she was going to be put somewhere. And she was clearly a fish out of water. And only someone with that aristocratic background could know the references in art, philosophy, music, literature that are throughout the diary. But, you know, the mystery is part of the magic. And in some ways, I don't really want to know what really her origin was. It doesn't matter. The diary itself exists, and it is stunning. It has been the love of my life, really. Oh, you asked about it being ripped up. It is, indeed. It is in little pieces that she has painstakingly pieced together. She said that her stepsister tore it up when they were still children, and she saved the pieces and stored them in the woods. In 1919, she found herself in Boston. Whole other, you know, across the country, speaking to Ellery Sedgwick, the editor of the Atlantic Monthly. And Opal was trying to interest him in a nature book she had written. He wasn't interested in that, but he did say to her, you know, you're such a fascinating person. You've had an amazing life. You must have kept a diary. Well, she said, yes, I did, but it was torn up. And he said, well, I will sponsor you. I will put you up at my mother-in-law's, and you can take however much time it takes to reconstruct it. And that's what happened. She took 9 months, pieced together the diary again, and it was published in serial form in the Atlantic Monthly and caused a sensation, so it was published in book form simultaneously in the U.S. and Britain in 1920.
Robert talks about the cast for his musical adventure, Opal.
I have been casting this in my mind for years. It's been off Broadway. I've wanted it to be seen here, and I have a dream cast. When I knew that the show was going to be done, I contacted people, and immediately everybody said yes. So I am just thrilled with the cast, including our 8-year-old star, Lily Adams, who was recently in The Music Man at the Paramount Theater that the symphony did. She is adorable and is going to be an astonishing Opal. She is strong, she's a great actress, and a fireball. She's going to be sensational. And the rest of the cast could not be more perfect. It's just the best of the best.
Iowa's own composer, librettist, and stage director, Robert Lindsay Nassif. For more details about the musical adventure Opal, based on the mysterious and magical childhood diary of Opal Whiteley, please see Robert Lindsay Nassif's website at robertlindsaynassif.com. To get tickets for the Midwest premiere of Opal at the CSPS in Cedar Rapids on January 31st, February 1st, 7th, and/or 8th, please go to legionarts.org or call the CSPS box office number 319-364-1580. If you need help finding information about concerts in Iowa, Iowa Public Radio has an events link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. We would also encourage you to add your own concerts and events to our site by clicking on the Add Events on the Events page. Adding your events to IPR's events calendar is just one of the many free cultural services Iowa Public Radio provides to our listeners and audience. Today's Iowa Art Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this production goes to Bill Ferrara, Robin Venter, John Herbert, and Robert Lindsay Nassif. Program assistance was also received from Mel Andringa, Todd Kim, and Virginia Mikolajczyk. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner. Thanks for this show also goes to Iowa Public Radio's music director, Al Scherz, along with Eric Jordan, Jason Burns, Garrett Van Leeuwen, and Cooper Holmeyer. Program research was provided by IPR's Nick Carlo. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.